Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is international best-selling writer Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas Newborn, Orthodox woman rabbi at Congregation B'nai David Judea in Los Angeles. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevinah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shin Shinin Bar El Chachar and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. After a week of unleavened food that ended either Monday night or Tuesday night, depending on whether you're Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox, Passover's now absolutely over. As we returned our home kitchen to its year-round chametz status, we discovered, as we do yearly, that we had lots of boxes of uneaten matzah. You know, you buy the 5 pounds of boxes of matzah because it's a much better deal. You need a couple of boxes for Seder, and then you end up with 2 boxes left at the end of Pesach, just when you really don't want to see matzah again for a very long time. So, what to do? How do you use up all those boxes of the unleavened bread of intestinal affliction? I have often suggested that since we burn chametz just before we begin Passover, we should therefore burn our leftover matzah after Passover. But this idea has never caught on. Instead, play us in this morning in her now classic song, Past to Jewish guest Michelle Citrin tells you 20 things you can do with matzah after Passover's over.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzah pick and play the guitar, and you can make a matzah license plate for your car. Use it as a coaster when you're drinking your beer, or you can throw it as confetti for a happy new year.
7. Insulate. 8.
Decorate.
9. Exfoliate.
10.
Constipate?
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Crumble up some matzah to line your hamster cage, or you can use it as a bookmark to hold your page. Break a stack of matzah when you practice your karate. Build a matzah doghouse for your doggy named Scotty. Make a little matzah board and wave it goodbye. Or you can make a pair of matzah wings and learn how to fly. Wear some matzah jewelry. Make a picture frame for me. Have a drink of matzah tea. Matzah's all that I can see. There's just one more thing to do with unleavened bread. You can eat it, 'cause it ain't all that bad.
That was Michelle Citrin's 20 Things to Do with Matzah After Passover's Over. If Pesach is over, as it is, that means we're now in the period of the counting of the Omer, the time between Passover, Festival of Freedom, and Shavuot, the holiday of covenant and Torah. For the 7 weeks between Pesach and Shavuos, we take a few moments each evening to say a blessing and to count the days that lead us towards a reaffirmation of our brit, our covenant with God, as certified at Mount Sinai. As the passage in Proverbs says, teach us to number our days so that we can make every day count. The counting of the Omer reminds us we have the capacity to make every single day matter and to bring holiness into our lives every day. In the Sfirat HaOmer, the prayer we chant each night, there's a famous passage, Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, may the temple be rebuilt speedily in our day. It's a classic text, but more than that, it's a metaphor for what we wish in our own lives at this time of year. May we continually seek to rebuild not only our temple, but ourselves. If we can do that, well, then we can rebuild our world. Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, as sung by cantor Ben-Sion Miller.
Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, imheru ve'yomenu, v'sein chelkenu besorosecho. Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, imheru ve'yomenu, yehir otzum yevonecho.
That was Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, a classic concert piece by Israel Shor, as sung by Chazan Ben-Sion Miller, a true cantorial tenor. It's for the period of the counting of the Omer, the agriculturally oriented time of dedication we have now entered on the Jewish calendar. In biblical times, up until the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans in the year 70, we Jews were primarily farmers, herdsmen, and keepers of orchards and vineyards. After a hiatus of 1,800 years or so, we returned to the land of Israel and again became connected in a tangible way to the natural world. But this agricultural element in our heritage has always remained, in chanting Torah, in our prayers and liturgy, in festival rituals. In this period, between Passover, the Festival of Freedom, and Shavuot, the holiday of receiving the Ten Commandments, we reconnect to the natural world that God has given us. We remind ourselves of our role as stewards of the earth, a great and good responsibility. Our guest this morning, Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas Newborn, is something the world has not quite gotten used to seeing yet, an Orthodox woman rabbi working as a rabbi in a modern Orthodox congregation in Los Angeles. Meet her, find out how she became a rabbi, why she chose to do so, and what her work is like when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Hi, my name is Lauriella, and I'd like to tell you how you can help send children like me to a Jewish day school at no cost to you. Arizona allows its taxpayers to receive a tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations such as JETCO. JETCO is the only tuition organization solely dedicated to Jewish education in Tucson. JETCO provides scholarships to children who attend qualified private schools like Congregation Anshai Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, which educates students from grades K through 8th. You may give up to $1,087 for single tax filers and $2,173 for married couples who file jointly. Jewish education nurtures Jewish identity for generations of students like me, so please go online and visit our website at www.jetco.org or give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. And tell them Lauriella sent you.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish Art guests this morning. Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas Newborn is assistant clergy, assistant spiritual leader at Temple B'nai David Judea in Los Angeles, an important modern Orthodox shul. I should note, in the interest of full disclosure, part of my bar mitzvah a million years ago was at Temple Judea, which is now a part of B'nai David Judea. She is maybe the most prominent woman rabbanit, or serving as a spiritual leader in Orthodox synagogue in the Los Angeles area, and part of a very interesting new movement. Good morning, and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi Sam. Thank you so much for having me. And it's such a beautiful kesher, a great connection that you had part of your bar mitzvah in our building.
Yeah, actually.
I feel very, very grateful.
Thank you. It was actually the other building, Judea, which is now, I think, a Korean Baptist church. But I went to services many times at B'nai David as well, where my old teacher and friend Marco Goldstein was the cantor many years ago. May he rest in peace. So it's a lovely kesher. Tell us a little bit about the process that led you to become a rabbanit. You've now been at B'nai David Judea for closing in on 3 years now, correct?
Yes. I went to Yeshivat Maharat, which is the first school to ordain Orthodox women, and it's located in New York. I attended the school. It's a four-year program where you study for smicha, for ordination, which includes learning halacha, all of the Jewish law around kashrut and nida, the family purity laws, and Shabbat, and all of the life cycle events. And in that learning, I was trained pastorally and halachically, and come out with the ordination, the smicha, from the school, and that's the training process. Fantastic program, and I was very blessed to be a part of it. And from there, I had several internships. One of them, Baruch Hashem, thank God, was at B'nai David Judea, and my husband and I actually moved out to L.A. Because he got a job as a lawyer, and I was able to be an intern at B'nai David for the year. So after the internship, they put out a search that they wanted to hire a woman full-time. I applied and got the job, and I've actually been, I'm closing in on my second full-time year at B'nai David, and coming to a total of three, really, serving this fantastic community.
You know, we had Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz on here on Two Jewish, almost 7 years ago now, 6.5 years ago, when, frankly, I never thought there would be Orthodox women ordained before the Messiah. It's a very fascinating period to be a woman in the Orthodox movement, isn't it? Orthodox world, I should say.
It absolutely is. I say this all the time, but I really feel blessed that in my lifetime, at the right time in my life in particular, that Yeshivat Maharat existed, that I could get this fantastic education and serve the community in this way, which was a calling that I felt for since I was very young. But you know, it's funny you say with Mashiach, with the Messiah coming, because there was a rabbi who told me once that you know he had learned that when women have their really take the reins of their role in Judaism and Orthodoxy and serving the community, that that's really when Mashiach will come. So Bezrat Hashem, that time is coming.
We will talk much more with Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas Newborn when we return in just a few moments here on Two Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at too2jewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in North America. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We talked a couple of weeks ago about the Jews of South America and the communities there, which are perceived by the general population as being larger, more influential than they are. But there are some important communities, and there's been some serious changes in some of them.
There are some important communities. I would say that was probably truer a generation ago than it is today. Most of them are declining in size. In pretty much all the big South American cities, whether it's Buenos Aires or Bogota or Rio or Sao Paulo or Caracas, a lot of Jews are leaving or have left for a wide variety of reasons. Either the United States, where many of them have relatives, or Israel have become more attractive options to them than continuing their lives in Latin America. Of course, many of the people who formed the backbones of these communities were Holocaust refugees, and they had to live with the uncomfortable fact that the same governments that welcomed them also welcomed ex-Nazis, of whom there's a great number in places like Paraguay and Argentina and a few other countries down there.
Yeah, including people like Mengele and Eichmann who got out and went there.
Well, they're not there anymore, but there are, you know, there are places with a lot of Germans, and many of the Germans today are either children or grandchildren of people who perpetrated one of history's most terrible crimes. But apart from that, there was a period when there was a rash of kidnappings in Argentina. More recently, there were acts of terror perpetrated against the Jewish community there. Buenos Aires probably had the biggest and most visible community in South America, and you know something about the seminary there.
Right, the Marshall Meyer Seminary in Buenos Aires, which produces many fine conservative rabbis and cantors and exports many of them to the United States and elsewhere around the world. Many prominent cantors and rabbis have come from there, including the first woman rabbi in Brazil, in Sao Paulo, who was installed not too long ago. So it's a very, still an important source of Judaism and Jewish learning, and it's very well thought of.
Right. But it's interesting that Argentina in particular exports Jewish clergy, for want of another word,
clay Kodesh,
right? Like cantors and rabbis, but imports Catholic priests. I mean, the wedding I attended of two Catholic friends a year and a half ago, the priest looked like he was from Central Casting, except he came from Poland and spoke Spanish with a very heavy Polish accent. And, you know, I asked him about that, and he said, yeah, very few young people here want to go into the priesthood. So Argentina imports priests from all over the old world, Italy, Spain, Poland, Hungary, etc.
Might be something to do with celibacy. I don't know. I can't speak for my Catholic colleagues, but it would definitely change the motivation. The Jewish community there, there's been one other interesting change. There's been a sort of export of Reform Judaism into Latin America, where it never really had much of a foothold. Over the last 10 years, there have been new congregations formed really throughout Latin America. So it'd be very interesting to just sort of see what happens to those Jewish communities, some of which go back, 400 years, to see where they go in the next decades.
Right. Actually, very few go back that far. I mean, the really historic communities were, from the original colonial powers of either Holland or Portugal. They were in Recife or Curacao or whatever. The big urban communities that we've been talking about are much more recent in origin.
Yeah, mostly before World War II or just after.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Leah Avuno, our Shin Shinit, representing the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Leah.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So Judaism has lots and lots of holidays, but Israel has a holiday that I don't think we have in America. Can you tell us about it?
So the name of it is Good Deeds Day, and it's basically
so it's
started
Yom
in...
Yom Ma'asim Tovim?
Yes, you'll translate as Yom Ma'asim Tovim, the day of doing good deeds. And it's something that started in Israel and by Sherry Harrison, which is a businesswoman, and she just wanted to make the Israeli society better. So when they started it, they didn't thought it's going to be like as big as it is now. But today people celebrate it in 75 different countries.
Wow.
And yeah, so a lot of people are part of this amazing thing. And basically it's teenagers and kids and elderly and young adults that are doing something for their community. Even if it's just simple things like giving a person a balloon or, I don't know, painting neighborhoods or volunteer in a a nursing
cleaning
home.
Up a park.
Yeah, cleaning up a park. Everything. Like, some people take it like really big and donate a huge amount of money to all kind of
good causes.
Organizations, right. And yeah, nonprofit organization and stuff. And well, in Kiryat Malachi, which is my city, and also Tucson Partnership Region, last year we bought 1,000 balloons, and we gave them to all the people in Kiryat Malachi. And Kiryat Malachi is a really small town, so I took 5 of them home because we had extra. but yeah, that was amazing. We woke up at 5, we tied it into cars, into people's mail boxes, and it was something really, really fun to do. So
in America, we have something called Giving Tuesday, in which people make donations, but we don't really have, like, this is our mitzvah day, you know, or I like that, you know, the day of good deeds.
Yeah.
Maybe you should start it here in America.
I will. That means that I need to stay another year because it's March 28th.
March 28th. So we have 11 months to prepare. All we have to do, using Two Jewish as our vehicle, we can tell the world that we need to have... Yom Ha'asim Tovim.
Yeah, I think some parts of United States also participate in that, but it's not as common.
It hasn't
quite
come across.
Give it like 5 years to be common, and everybody will know about it.
When you come back the next time, I promise we'll get this started.
Okay.
Thanks, Leah. Great way to do mitzvot. We'll talk soon.
Toda rabba.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So, by the way, I since you like matzah so much, I've got all my leftover matzah. You can take it to THA.
Sweet.
Sweet is not a word I attach to matzah unless you put a little, you know, caramelized sugar on it or something.
Or the chocolate-covered matzah.
Chocolate-covered matzah. We talked about freedom, though, and while the matzah may stick around, the whole question of freedom is not just something we should talk about on Pesach or even in the counting of the Omer period. With freedom comes responsibility.
Yes.
How do we teach that most effectively while preserving that notion of freedom?
Right. So, you know, just because we live in a free society doesn't mean that the story ends there. What's that Spider-Man quote with
great freedom, with great power comes great responsibility.
Exactly. That was it. But it's also true with freedom, with great freedom.
Should be Peter Parker Stein or Parker Berg or something.
Yeah. So, as we teach about, you know, the ethics and the values of what it means to be a free people, we also teach right in there, hand in glove, about the responsibilities that freedom brings with it. Because we live in a free society, we have greater responsibilities to take care of ourselves, to take care of our neighbors, to take care of our community, our planet, our people. And in a free society, it's very easy to kind of let things go. We see assimilation as this great steamroller that can flatten out culture and faith and religion here in America. So along with those freedoms, we've got real responsibilities. How do you teach responsibilities? You make a case for those things that are important. You educate, you expose, you bring a level of awareness, and then you create kind of a call to action, an imperative. A great example of that that we do at Tucson Hebrew Academy is a program called Passport to Peace. Every year, our student government invites 12 to 15 charities from throughout the community who come and set up a booth. And either students talk with students or representatives of those organizations talk to students about what they're doing in our community to make the community a better place. And so it's a great example of how to promote awareness and give an opportunity for an action step right there in the lives of children.
So with freedom, not only responsibility, but the call to action, the call to act to help everyone else experience the blessings of freedom.
And weaving those values of tikkun olam, of tzedakah, through actual giving on maybe a little bit of tzedakah for Shabbat or other times when there is an appropriate moment to make a gift or a contribution. And then looking for ways to improve our society, healing the world, tikkun olam. So many great opportunities to do that here in Tucson.
Thanks, John. We will continue to work for freedom and we will talk next week.
Thanks for making the world a better place, everybody.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rabbi Joseph's was cleaning the house for Passover when he came across a box he didn't recognize. His wife told him, "Leave it alone. It's personal." But one day after Pesach, when she was out, his curiosity got the best of him. He opened the box. Inside, he found 3 eggs and $2,000. When his wife came home, he admitted he'd opened the box, and he asked her to explain the contents. She told him, every time the rabbi gave a bad sermon, him, she'd put an egg in the box. Rabbi Joseph said, "You know, in 20 years, only 3 bad sermons. Not too bad." So his wife continued, "And every time I got a dozen eggs, I sold them for $1. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portion of Tazria Metzora in the book of Leviticus, Vayikra, and a wholly unappetizing set of Torah portions it is indeed. Metzora in particular focuses on the question of leprosy, a dread disease of the ancient world. It's true, leprosy was awful, and it needed to be eliminated if at all possible, in particular by using the concept of quarantine to isolate the people who suffered from it. But exploring what our ancestors believed to be an infectious disease at great length on Shabbos service can scarcely be called a spiritually meaningful experience. The rabbis of our tradition recognized this problem and came up with an ingenious and meaningful interpretation. The word mitzorah, which means leprosy, was itself, they said, an abbreviation for the term in Hebrew, motzi shem ra, which means slander or evil speech. That interpretation was based on evidence found in the Torah itself. Moses' hand became leprous when he expressed doubt about the willingness of the people to believe in his mission. Miriam was struck by leprosy when she spoke aloud against Moses. In another instance, a leper is a person who speaks badly about others. Evil speech, Lashon Hara, and its even darker partner, Motzi Shem Ra, slander, were considered by the sages to be among the worst sins. What needed to be eliminated from society was not just the biological illness of leprosy, but these terrible infections of slander and gossip. the ways in which we employ language lead to many of the worst problems in society. Lashon Hara, Maimonides taught, is not only a terrible epidemic disease, but even a multiple murderer, killing three people. The one who shares gossip, the one who hears gossip, and the one who is the subject of gossip. According to Jewish law, even gossip with a kernel of truth in it is Lashon Hara, evil speech, and inherently wrong. It causes intense societal damage. Some authorities, such as the great rabbi known as the Chofetz Chaim, go so far as to say that even gossiping about the truth is morally heinous. There's an interesting parallel in our own law code in the United States. There's a legal concept in American jurisprudence called the fruit of the poison tree, which rules out the use of evidence collected improperly. That is, any discovery gathered in such a way is tainted and thus not legally admissible. So it is with Mitzora and all other forms of Lashon Hara, evil speech in Judaism. Whether the gossip has elements of truth in it or not, it is derived from a fundamentally corrupted source and must be discounted. Our moral goal in life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and habits motzi shem ra, that awful tendency we all have to speak ill of others. The rabbis teach that if you commit no slander, your own life can become clean of moral illness. By purifying our speech of words that are damaging to others, we can find our way clear to living better, holier lives. Our portion this week even delineates forms of Mitzora that affect the very houses in which we live, Mitzora at Bait. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of the property, it may even need to be destroyed. That's along the lines of Abraham Lincoln's concept that a house divided against itself cannot stand. If we wish to have not only personal lives, but organizations, synagogues, and communities in which holiness can flourish, the dreadful sin of slander must be eliminated. May we each do our part, now and always, to remove Mitzora, personal impurities of speech, from our own lives, from our institutions, from our community. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas Newborn, will explain just what an Orthodox woman rabbi's role is in a contemporary modern Orthodox synagogue. Find out when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Trump administration certified that Iran is in compliance with the deal it signed with world powers to rein in its nuclear program. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson last week sent a letter to Speaker of the House Paul Ryan certifying Tehran's compliance with the 2015 deal, which exchanges sanctions relief for a rollback on Iran's nuclear program. The State Department has to update Congress on Iran's compliance with the nuclear deal every 90 days. This was the first update for the Trump administration. The certification was the latest signal that President Donald Trump, who campaigned against the Iran deal, as did all Republican candidates, and said he would scrap it his first day in office, as president has now adopted a more toned-down posture to the Iranian regime. Trump imposed sanctions on Iranian individuals and businesses after Iran tested ballistic missiles earlier this year, but so did President Barack Obama a year ago after a similar test. Trump has not otherwise focused on Iran. Nevertheless, the letter to Ryan said Trump was ready to review the nuclear deal in light of Iran's backing of terrorism. Iran remains a leading state sponsor of terror through many platforms and methods, it said. Trump has directed a National Security Council-led intra-agency review of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action that will evaluate whether suspension of sanctions related to Iran pursuant to the JCPOA is vital to the national security interests of the United States. The U.S. partners in the deal, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China, would certainly balk at linking compliance with the Iranian nuclear deal with Iran's support of terrorism. Last month, Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu talked about the Iran nuclear deal by phone. The two leaders spoke at length about the dangers posed by it and by Iran's malevolent behavior in the region and about the need to work together to counter those dangers, read Netanyahu's statement about it. But so far, the Iranian nuclear deal stands, and the Trump administration has officially certified that Iran is in compliance to this point. In other news, Judy Blume, who helped generations of adolescents overcome teen awkwardness in books like Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, will be awarded the E.B. White Award, a Lifetime Achievement Award for Children's Literature, next month. Part of the prize is $10,000 given by the American Academy of Arts and Letters. The 79-year-old Blume is prolific. She's written 30 books for children, teens, and adults. Judy Blume is not often thought of as a Jewish writer, but many of her books deal with Jewish identity, notably starring Sally J. Friedman as herself, about a young Jewish girl who moves from New Jersey to Miami. Blume helped countless teens deal with the strangeness of growing up, as her books tackle racism, menstruation, divorce, bullying, masturbation, and sexuality. This is something Blume mentioned wishing she had had in adolescence. I wanted to be honest in my writing, she says. I felt that no adult had been honest with me. Blume was named a living legend by the Library of Congress in 2000, received the annual Distinguished Contribution to American Letters Medal of the National Book Foundation back in 2004. And just as ironic as the fact that White Christmas and Easter Parade were written by Irving Berlin, Peeps, the famously neon-colored marshmallow Easter treats, are also produced by Jews. Based in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, I kid you not, Just Born Quality Confections has been churning out these decidedly non-kosher sugary sweets since 1953 when it purchased the Rada Candy Company. Roscoe Rada actually came up with the original concept of 3D marshmallows, but Jewish immigrant Sam Born developed the Peeps that we know today. Educated at a yeshiva in the Ukraine, Sam Born learned the candy business as a teenager when his family fled to France. In 1910, he got to the United States and 6 years later was awarded the key to the city of San Francisco for inventing a machine that inserts sticks into lollipops. Joined by his brother-in-law, Jack Schaefer, and Jack's brother, Irv, Sam Born opened candy stores emphasizing freshness with the tagline, Just Born. Just Born prospered even through the Depression. In 1932, it moved to a large manufacturing facility in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. From there, the company introduced brands like Mike and Ike's and Hot Tamales, which they still make. But Peeps are the real cultural phenomenon. It took Rada 27 hours to make one marshmallow peep by hand, but Born and his son Bob mechanized the process, and it took just 6 minutes. By the 1960s, shapes other than the iconic Easter chick were introduced. Today, there are 50 varieties offered year-round, in conjunction with holidays like Halloween and Christmas. A staggering 5.5 million Peeps are produced every day. The company has Peeps retail stores with T-shirts declaring, Imagine World Peeps. Peeps, get it? Fans can also participate in annual Peep Diorama contest held across the country where scenes are recreated using Peeps. The Born family still runs the Peeps manufacturing company, Just Born, and it has a strong tradition of supporting Jewish causes. It's been honored by the Federation of Jewish Philanthropy, the United Jewish Appeal, and the Israeli government's Shema Yisrael Award, and the Borns are in the Candy Hall of Fame. Who knew there was a Candy Hall of Fame? And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas Newborn. She is Assistant Spiritual Leader and on the clergy staff at Congregation B'nai David Judea and Orthodox Modern Orthodox Shul in Los Angeles. We've been talking about what it is to be serving in this role. Tell us what led you to decide to seek ordination and to go through the education that you did. It was not an ordinary choice for an Orthodox woman.
That's a great question. I remember when I was 15 years old, in my community, there had been several losses all at once. There had been someone who a father in the community who had died suddenly, and a friend of mine died from suicide. And my own father actually had had a heart attack and two strokes and was having quadruple bypass surgery. And all of that happened. Thank God my father's okay and still alive and well today. But all of that happened around the same time, within about a month or so. And I found myself in hospitals and at funerals. And I remember sitting and looking at the rabbis around me and how they handled the situation and how they really stepped in to provide support and love and also a great deal of holiness, the presence of God in times when we often don't expect to connect to God at all. And when I saw that, I felt this calling to do that same work. This is where I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to be in those moments of darkness that come out in this world and to be a source of connection, to be a source of love and to bring humbly God's presence into places where we don't normally expect to find God. And that was really the moment when I first felt that calling and connection. And it developed over many years in terms of what it looked like. And as I mentioned before, I have the great merit of having gone to Yeshivat Maharat, having been a part of the first school ordaining Orthodox women, which fell out, you know, and historically to be in the time that worked, it was part of my life. I'm very lucky because there's so many women who came before me who have the same level of strong education but didn't have necessarily the school, the community in the same way. So I'm also blessed that I have a bunch of women that, you know, colleagues who I'm close with, who I can turn to. And that calling continues today. I'm so blessed to be at B'nai David Judea, to work with Rav Yosef Konevsky, and to serve the community in those moments of darkness, and also teach Torah, to bring that holiness and that godliness in, but also to be with them, Bezrat Hashem, God willing, in moments of joy and light. Those times of Simcha are such a gift.
You know, there's a stereotype that a rabbi is a person who leads services. That's not particularly accurate in a traditional setting. What kinds of roles do you fulfill for your congregation, and what kinds of roles are they not comfortable with you fulfilling that they might expect a male rabbi to fulfill?
So on a daily basis, I provide pastoral care, I counsel people, I give Divrei Torah. So you talk about leading services in a shul setting. So for example, at Shacharit, at morning services, I wouldn't be leading the services. That would be, you know, whatever man, Shliach Tzibor, is leading it at the time. But I will give a Divrei Torah at the end. I'll give, you know, a thought for the day. And I teach classes. I teach shirim throughout the week. I give drushas. I give sermons on Shabbat. I also answer halachic questions, shilas, about any sort of topic that someone might have. So, for example, when I'm asked Jewish legal questions, different different shilas that I get, I could get one on kashrut. Let's say someone had something happen in the kitchen, they give me a call. And because I'm a woman in this field, I also get a lot of nida shilas. I get questions around family purity, women's bodies, women's menstruation. And what's powerful about that is a woman gets to actually speak with a woman, which is something, you know, that this is a field. Having women in these leadership roles spiritually has been transformative for, I know, a lot of people in our community. And the U.S. at Halakha program, for example, is another way in which women are serving women, answering these kinds of questions, specifically with family purity laws. But I've had so many women come to, you know, my front door of my home on the verge of tears with questions about how to deal with certain things pertaining to their bodies, and I'm privileged that I can answer them with sensitivity and with real understanding.
You know, it has always seemed to me it made a lot more sense for a woman to answer questions on family purity and the mikveh than for a guy to do so. So I can understand why that would be powerful and transformative. Are there areas in which you have received resistance, either within the congregation or outside the congregation, in your role as a female spiritual leader in the Orthodox world?
I mean, there are definitely people who are not going to support women in spiritual leadership in Orthodoxy. But halakhically, there is absolutely room for women to be serving in roles like I am. I mean, it's, of course, important to balance that in our Orthodox community with the actual limitations. So as I said before, I wouldn't be leading the davening. I wouldn't be leading the service. But I think, as with many things, you know, there are communities in which having a woman as a spiritual leader is something that is welcomed and people are excited about, and it's very, very needed. And there's other communities where it's not the right fit, or it wouldn't be something that would work well. And just having the option there for different shuls, I think, is essential.
When you began this process, what did your family think about it? What did your friends think about it?
My family, my friends, I'm very lucky, were supportive throughout. I've always had a great deal of support from my parents. My parents are both very spiritual people, and in general, all of my friends have been curious and excited and often very proud of me.
I'm glad to hear that. I wouldn't have been surprised if there was some resistance, but do you find that you relate to women rabbinic colleagues in other movements as well?
Absolutely. I have had the opportunity to do several different rabbinic fellowships. One, for instance, recently in Los Angeles called ADA through the Federation. And in those different environments where you have interdenominational programming, where you have clergy coming together, there are so many women clergy that I know of who are Reformed, Conservative, different, you know, the whole gamut, who I really connect with. Because I think, you know, even if we're serving our communities in somewhat different ways, there's so much more in common. And the moments of real excitement and joy and growth, and also some of the moments of struggle are shared.
What is your favorite part about the rabbinic work that you're doing, about being a rabbanit in your setting?
I really do love it all. I love being able to...
There must be something you like better than other parts. There has to be.
I think the pastoral moments, connecting with people pastorally, in counseling moments, in life cycle events. I also, in addition to my training at Yeshivat Maharat, I'm a board certified chaplain. So I've spent time working in different hospitals, especially around palliative care and end of life care and psychiatric care, where I've been in those, in what I consider extraordinarily holy moments. You imagine Moses at the burning bush, and God says, you have to take off your shoes. This is a holy ground you're standing on. And I'm very thankful that I often get to have that feeling. And it's often being with someone when they really are in need, or they're in search of a connection. For example, every Thursday morning, I lead a support group at B'nai David Judea that we started here a few years ago, called Bri'ut HaNefesh, and it's a mental wellness support group. And people come together who are really striving to have mental wellness in their lives. They may be suffering from their own mental illness or caring for a loved one with a mental illness, but being able to come together and try to find meaning, I always bring a little taste of Torah to connect to that, of having some sort of a Jewish lens to have the conversation. I love blending the pastoral with the wealth of wisdom and comfort and love that our tradition, that God's tradition, offers us.
And the corollary, what is the most challenging thing for you to do in your role as a rabbanit? What do you find the most difficult? You didn't think all the questions would be easy, did you?
Oh, well, I mean, this is a difficult one, right?
Sure.
Yeah, my gut, my initial instinct was just like all of the emails. You know, there's so many logistical things that you would
see.
Never
see, I would say all the meetings, but you know, that's me. Everybody's got different.
Right, like on a day to day basis, just you know, making sure that I am responding to everything, getting everything done. The logistical part that you know you don't always hear clergy talk about. But I would also say probably the, you know, just as I've been talking about how important and holy those moments can be when you're in those dark places, I think there's also for anyone in a caring profession, you know, learning to have that self-care, to care for yourself. And you know, it's a very natural thing when you're in a caring profession to want to take on everything that you hear and hold it in yourself. And I think, you know, it can be a lot.
I have one final question. The Orthodox Union adopted a kind of policy against women being called rabbi or officially fulfilling the role of clergy, although it's not clear how much of the Orthodox world will observe that. What are your observations on that? This was about a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, they adopted that policy.
Yeah. Well, in our synagogue, I'm continuing to do my job. Everything that I mentioned before, serving the community with Torah and mitzvot and pastoral care and answering legal questions. And my response is to continue doing that. There's definitely a need here. And we also, our school is an OU school. We've had a history of a very positive relationship with the OU, and we hope to continue to going forward in the future.
I want to thank Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas-Newborn for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about your synagogue and about you?
If you would like to learn more about B'nai David, you can go to B'nai David, B-N-A-I, David.com. And we also have an app. So if you would like to get a little Devar Torah on a daily basis from either me or from Rav Yosef, our rabbi, or to look at some past shearing, to listen to some past classes, connect with us in any way. You can even ask Shilas. You can even ask Jewish legal questions. Our app is available. And I encourage you, if you're in LA, to come to our shul for Shabbat. Come visit us. You're always welcome to email me. My email is rabbanitalyssa@benedavis.com. Thank you so much, Rabbi Sam, for having me on this talk.
It's been a great pleasure. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest will be Richard Michelson, author of the new kids' book, The Language of Angels, a story about the reinvention of Hebrew. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TwoJewishRadio.com website and friend us on Facebook. Also, you can join us this afternoon at 2 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel if you are here in Tucson for our community Yom HaShoah commemoration, remembering the Holocaust. Our playout this morning comes from Israel. It's the delightful affirmation that life, in spite of tzoras, is actually good and enjoyable. It's called HaChaim Shelanu Tutim. Our life is like strawberries by Hanan Ben Ari. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. זכות בכלל להתלונן הכל תפוך חמסה וברוך השם כי החיים שלנו תותים החיים שלנו תותים החיים שלנו תותים החיים שלנו תותים שעות של תור בדואר קשה לגמור פה תואר והמצב בנוער קשה לשיר כמו זוהר להתעורר בבוקר להיכנס לכושר הדלק שוב ביוקר והמוזה היא בעוצר שחיתות בכל שבועיים
כל יומיים ארנונה בשמיים והטסק בירושלים כשבא לבית נושא וגם הבוס נוקשה אז הפכתי למושה לא הכל פרר או רושה אבל אין לנו זכות בכלל להתלונן הכל תפוך המסה וברוך השם כי החיים שלנו תותים החיים שלנו תותים החיים שלנו תותים החיים שלנו היידי
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.